Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, Taupō residents observe water restrictions as the town copes with a massive sewage spill. A Far North Māori Social Services Agency says it's been able to stop children being taken into state care by getting whānau to take responsibility instead. And Forest and Bird are calling on the government and councils to increase their 1080 predator control, saying rats are running riot through the nation's forest and tussock land.
States actually feed off rats. So with the exceptional numbers of rats that we've got in our forests this year, that will lead to high numbers of stoats as well.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, tens of thousands of firearms will be crunched by a hydraulic press after gun owners hand them in to police at collection events that begin next week. Almost 1,000 guns have already been handed in, and another 8,000 have been flagged for surrender through the online registration process. That's a good start, but over the next 6 months, they're expecting tens of thousands to be handed in and destroyed under the scheme introduced in the wake of the Christchurch mosque attacks. Our police reporter Ben Strang went to Upper Hutt on Thursday, where police demonstrated the process that gun owners will go through.
The sound of gun barrels being crushed will reverberate around collection venues until the end of the gun amnesty on the 20th of December. It's one of the final stages of the gun buyback process, rendering a firearm useless before it's shipped away to be melted down or disposed of. The police have purchased a number of hydraulic presses from a family engineering business in Christchurch to do that job, demonstrated today at a mock version of the process at Trentham Racecourse near Wellington. Senior Sergeant Braden Lenihan lays out what gun owners will experience when they attend a collection event.
So before we go any further, the first thing that will happen is we'll come to the safe zone. In the safe zone, there are a number of bullet traps, firearms, chamber flags, and the first member that they will meet asks them if they've cleared their firearm, assists them to clear their firearm, and make sure that the firearm is safe and clear so that everybody is safe on the site when they arrive through and carry on through the event.
From there, the gun owner will be directed to the buyback counter, where they'll sort out the financial details, or to the amnesty desk for people who aren't eligible for compensation. For those who haven't completed the online form detailing their guns, they'll be asked to do that first. Handing a gun in under the amnesty will be seamless, but if you're seeking compensation, things will take a little longer. The gun owner will need to agree on the condition of the gun, as Senior Sergeant Paddy Hannon demonstrated as he took on the role of a generic gun owner.
So how would you rate the condition of your firearm?
Oh, it's about 20 years old, so it's certainly been used.
Fairly used? Absolutely. Just taking a look at it, sir, I would absolutely put that in the use category.
With that done, the gun knows its fate. The hydraulic press awaits. Deputy Commissioner Mike Clement says 15 people are employed to run collection events in each of the 12 police districts. 108 people have been hired as short-term contractors, and the rest are existing police staff. Mr. Clement says the police have no idea how busy they'll be during the first few months of collections.
Well, in actual fact, what you've seen here today is a team of 9 plus the security, so a team of 15 I've talked about in each of the 12 districts. For Canterbury, on the first occasion on that Saturday the 13th, we will have 2 teams in location. So we've got a surge capability. But the reality is we don't know. We've said all the way through we don't really know how many people are going to turn up on that day and other days. No one can know, and so all we're doing is making sure that we are agile enough to meet the demand, and if we're not, we'll change it up to make sure that we are.
The Police Minister, Stuart Nash, was impressed with what he saw at Trentham Racecourse and says he expects the collection events to be a success. That's despite not knowing how many people are expected to turn out.
Well, as the Deputy Commissioner said, the police have the ability to surge. So if we find the demand is a lot greater than the officers on duty, then more will come in. And obviously the first one at Riccarton is a bit of a test. Again, as the Deputy Commissioner has outlined, if in fact it's taking longer than the police expect, then they will make sure that the resources are at the next one. And I have complete confidence in the police to do a fantastic job, as they have done, in putting the whole process together.
The first of the gun collection events is set for Riccarton Racecourse next weekend, running from 10 until 3. Nearly 300 further events are planned for the first 3 months of the collection scheme, with more to be added for later in the year.
That report from our police reporter Ben Strang on Thursday's Checkpoint program. Dairy farmers have overwhelmingly voted to sell their 150-year-old dairy cooperative, Westland Milk Products, to a Chinese company. After years of low payouts and mounting debt, the board put the country's second largest milk producer up for sale and recommended farmer shareholders accept a $588 million offer from Yili conglomerate. But despite signing off on the deal, many of the 350 shareholders have been left with a sour taste in their mouths. Maya Burry filed this report from Greymouth for Thursday's Checkpoint program.
The reality is, if we don't sell, there won't be a dairy industry on the West Coast.
Why?
Because we're going, the bloody company is bankrupt.
This is the best thing we've got to sell. How
can that is bankrupt, man. Do you know what it means? Bankrupt means?
That's crazy.
Yeah, because you don't know.
West Coast dairy farmer and former director of the cooperative, Jim Wafflebaker, didn't take kindly to two protesters doorstopping today's shareholder meeting. While the company isn't bankrupt, as Jim describes it, it is hundreds of millions of dollars in debt and has struggled to pay farmers a competitive price for their milk for several years. Mr. Wafflebaker says he would not have been amongst the 94% of shareholders that backed selling up if the situation wasn't desperate.
I certainly would not have, but because I love the cooperative. I mean, I've been a director on this company for 25 years, you see. So I always fought for this company and was always loyal to the company, but for various reasons, it went the wrong way. And now it's just a matter of survival on the West Coast for the dairy industry.
The sale isn't done and dusted yet. It still needs approval from the Overseas Investment Office. But the company's board has indicated it doesn't expect that to be a problem. Westland Milk shareholder Tom Taft says it's a shame farmers weren't presented with any other options to vote on, such as retaining partial ownership.
We had an option B and C. It might have been a different thoughts, but you never know.
Where do you think things went wrong?
They knew they were in trouble, so why did they carry on doing what they were doing?
Another dairy farmer, Graham Nalon, voted against the proposal. He says he did so in protest.
Very sad, actually. Yeah, I'll probably have a tear when I get home. I'm a cooperative man, true and true, I suppose. Yeah, and it's just pretty sad to see the demise of, what's really a West Coast institution.
The proposed sale is worrying some West Coasters, including the Grey District's mayor, who fears jobs at one of the area's biggest employers could slowly slip away from the region. West Coast local Kathleen Potter, who was protesting outside the meeting this morning, shares this concern.
Well, I think we should be trying to keep ownership in New Zealand of our important infrastructure and our food production facilities. I don't see why we should be selling them to a foreign government. I think they're really struggling financially, but I don't think this is going to help them long term. I think it's a short-term solution, but long term they're going to regret it.
The company's chair, Pete Morrison, says it's not privy to Yili's long-term plans, but they have been told by the Chinese group it will be business as usual until they get their feet under the desk. Mr. Morrison says Yili has capital to invest and he thinks they will create more jobs in time. He says while he understands some farmers were disappointed about losing the cooperative structure, the sale will ultimately give them greater financial security. If all goes well, Yili will take over the co-op by the start of next month.
Maya Burry with that report from Checkpoint. And a dairy industry economist is warning that Fonterra's financial state is so bad, it's at risk of following Westland Milk Products into foreign ownership. The West Coast Dairy Cooperative was founded 150 years ago, but on Thursday in Greymouth, its farmer shareholders voted overwhelmingly to accept a $588 million offer from the Chinese Yili conglomerate. The sale still requires the approval of the Overseas Investment Office, but with Yili already owning a dairy plant in South Canterbury, that's not expected to be a hurdle. Economist Peter Fraser says the problems that led to the sale of Westland Milk are happening on a much larger scale with Fonterra. He joined Corin Dan in our Wellington Morning Report studio.
We can't afford to buy Westland. There's not the capital in New Zealand.
Sure, but isn't that, you mentioned Tip Top, isn't that the point? Yes, Fonterra recognises that it's got issues with capital, the amount of money it has to run its other parts of the business.
Yep.
And it's selling tip-top. It's dealing with that. It's putting itself in a stronger position. It's got a plan in place to deal with that. So why
the plan's not credible.
Why
I
not?
Mean, and the fact that the share price is tanking suggests that the market thinks their plan's not credible.
Which, of course, was the vote yesterday to sell Westland Dairy has caused quite a bit of controversy. And there are some arguing that our largest dairy company, Fonterra, could be heading down a similar route. As it's also got some issues in terms of its balance sheet. Well, joining us now is economist Peter Fraser. Good morning, Peter.
Atamare,
you believe that when we look at Westland Dairy, a co-op which got into some financial difficulties, it's been sold, well, in principle, to a foreign buyer, you believe that Fonterra, which is much, much bigger, could have the same structural problems. Why?
They do have the same structural problems. When co-ops go bad, they go bad very badly. And they fall into what we call a death spiral. And the death spiral basically happens when you have a too weaker balance sheet, you can't recapitalise the balance sheet, you therefore start losing milk supply, you therefore can't pay farmers a decent return, you lose more milk supply, your capacity utilisation at plant goes down, and you go into a downward spiral. And once you get into that downward spiral, you can't get out of it.
Sure, but let's look at Fonterra. They are they're $20 billion in revenue.
Yep.
They've got a milk price forecast that's around $7, which historically is pretty reasonable.
Yep.
That doesn't sound like a company that's in trouble.
Bigger they are, the harder they fall, Corin. It's as simple as that. I mean, where you look at Fonterra, it's not at the point yet where it would tip over. But the point is, because of its size, if it did tip over, and this is the point that I've been making about foreign ownership, there's no one big enough in New Zealand, unless we use the super fund or something like that, so it would need government intervention to do it. But look, we can't even afford to buy Tip Top. We can't afford to buy Silver Fern Farms. We can't afford to buy Westland. There's not the capital in New Zealand.
Sure, but isn't that, you mentioned Tip Top, isn't that the point? Yes, Fonterra recognises that it's got issues with capital, the amount of money it has to run its other parts of the business.
Yep.
And it's selling Tip Top. It's dealing with that. It's putting itself in a stronger position. It's got a plan in place to deal with that. So why
the plan's not credible.
Why
I
not?
Mean, and the fact that the share price is tanking suggests that the market thinks their plan's not credible. Selling assets, look, I don't have a problem with them selling assets. It's not a stamp collection where you have intrinsic value about things and you keep it because you like Rachel Hunter driving around in a Volkswagen. It's the important thing with the company is that they need to strengthen their balance sheet. For them to strengthen their balance sheet, asset sales will not do it alone. They need a recapitalisation. If they were a normal company, what they'd be doing now is putting out a whacking great big rights issue. Now, the equivalent for a co-op is a whacking great big retention. And
yeah,
that's what
but
they
because
need to do.
They're not a normal company, and you'd mentioned the share price, that isn't like, it's a slightly different share structure than a normal company. For
it's
people
a very different share structure
yeah,
from
so
a normal company.
So it could theoretically go to zero. It's not like...
No, I've said that, yes. They can absolutely go to zero. It's not a good thing, but and it would destroy an enormous amount of farmer value. Because remember...
Yeah, but it might go back up again once they've resorted things out, so they've got time to turn this around. It's not like they're facing the pressure necessarily of perhaps other companies because of that co-op structure.
Well, where the co-op structure protects them is from takeover. Before I came into the interview, I had a little check off Fonterra's balance sheet. They've got about $6.6 billion worth of equity. Now, their company valuation as of yesterday, last night, was only 5.6. So if they were a normal company, they'd be taken over and broken up by now. So the fact they're a co-op and their ownership is not up for grabs at the moment, that does protect them, that gives them time. But what I'm not seeing from Fonterra is any sense of urgency about what they need to do. Look, a friend of mine summarised it yesterday really, really well. He said, look, if you are flying a plane and every light on the dashboard is glowing, you don't have to be Chuck Yeager to work out there's a problem. But hey, you probably need to be Chuck Yeager to get out of this, and we look at Fonterra and there's no Chuck Yeager.
But what you're prescribing is for farmers to take less money. You're saying that Fonterra needs to hold back some of the money that they give to farmers. They're sitting and not give them as much money. Now, the 11,000, 12,000 dairy farmers in Fonterra, they're not going to buy into that, are they? That's what Fonterra's set up for. Get the best price.
Here's a really simple thing, farmers, and join John Moynihan, take this on board now. You either want to have your co-op or you don't want to have your co-op. Because if you want to have your co-op, you've got to buy it back. it's got too much debt. And the only way you can buy it back is by farmers buy it back. Because if you don't buy it back now, someone else will buy it back. You're going to go the same way as Murray Goulburn.
Yeah, but this is interesting, because we're at a time in New Zealand when dairy debt is very large in this country. We hear warnings about it from the Reserve Bank.
We know I've been warning about it for 10 years.
4 years ago, it was only about 4 or 5 years ago that Fonterra was actually having to loan its farmers some money because the milk price went so low. You can't. It's pretty hard to turn around and say to farmers right now, cough up some more cash to pump into Fonterra.
Well, as I said, farmers have got to make a decision. Look, farmers have said for generations having a strong co-op is really important for farmers. And that's what they've said for generations. So they've got to decide, going forward, is having a strong co-op important for farmers? Because if it is, they need to recapitalise their co-op. If it's not important, then they can sell it. I mean, it's their choice. It's their company.
Well, it is their choice. But Fonterra is a New Zealand Inc. company. In New Zealand, arguably, New Zealand's fortunes as an economy can sort of be determined by how well Fonterra is going. So at what point do the rest of the country say, if the farmers aren't getting it right, do we step in and do something?
Yeah, well, this is the problem we have with, I mean, the comparison I'd make is it's like heading towards the event horizon in a black hole. Once you've crossed the event horizon,
it's too late.
It's too late. We are not at too late. And there are a number of things we could do. And what I've said now for a number of weeks, there are things that Fonterra needs to do about recapitalising its balance sheet. Yes, do the asset sales. I don't have a problem with that. But it needs new equity as well. They also need to go and give the market some confidence that because the share is tanking, that is not important to them in a certain extent. But if I was a farmer, remember, farmers have burnt $3 billion of their shareholder value in 13 months. That's astonishing. If I was a farmer, I'd be bloody angry about that. And I'd be wanting to know what on earth you're doing about it. So, look, farmers are hurting now because they're not doing anything. I'm saying they're better off to go and do something and save their damn company.
The government just reviewed the dairy legislation, which Fonterra have often complained about because they are forced to pick up milk from places they don't want to. They got some changes there. So surely that should help, shouldn't it?
No. To be honest, what Fonterra actually wanted to do was novel the open entry and exit provisions. That's basically the ability to have farmer switching. Remember I said earlier, one of the key points of when co-ops go to a death spiral is they lose milk supply. Fonterra has already got too many factories which have got not enough milk. It's already got a stranded asset risk. We're at peak cow in New Zealand, so we've not got any increasing milk supply. So it means if Yilly or Uncle Tom Cobley or somebody else builds a new factory, they will fill it with milk. They get it from Fonterra. So what Fonterra wanted out of the deer review was the ability that effectively traps their farmers in Fonterra.
All right. Give us a couple of things that they could do, in your view, then, that to turn things around.
Okay, whacking great big retention this year out of the milk price of at least 50 cents. What they need to be saying is to farmers, you will get a milk price with a 6 in front of it. It may have nothing behind it.
Just to remind people what 50 cents means. So for
that's
an average,
about 700. That's about,
how much is that for an average dairy farm to have to give up?
That's about 75 grand.
So the average dairy farmer out there listening this morning is going to give up 75 grand.
That's what they have to do. Otherwise, they give up the co-op.
That's that simple.
It's that simple.
But, okay, finally, what's the problem here with Westland? When you look at the amount that Yilly has paid for those dairy farmers that have been battling away over there, getting a lower milk price than Fonterra, hey, this is great for them, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they've already gone past the event horizon and down the black hole. And once you enter a black hole, you can end up anywhere like Twizel, and that's not a good place. So in terms of where they've ended up, they've probably come out of this actually pretty well. But I'm really quite sad because they didn't have to go there
in the first place.
They've made the best of a bad deal.
What's the problem with foreign ownership? Let's hypothetically say, you know, at some point down the track, someone does buy into Fonterra and it is some foreign ownership. What would be the problem for New Zealand? Because the farms are still producing the milk.
Yep.
They're still getting the same price. The money's still going out to the rural economy.
Yep.
Where's the bit that's bad?
Personally, I didn't have a problem with it. Good foreign investment, I didn't have a problem with it. I don't buy the whole xenophobia thing. And I think that the right foreign investment is actually very positive.
That's economist Peter Fraser on Friday's Morning Report programme. Taupo residents will have to keep observing water restrictions for another 3 to 5 days as the town copes with a massive sewage spill. Scientists say it will take several months for pollution on the lake bed to disappear, but the sewage that flowed into the Waikato River is unlikely to pose health risks downstream. Cambridge, Hamilton and Auckland take water from the Waikato for their own supplies, and contamination levels are being monitored. The spill happened on Tuesday when a water main burst, creating a washout that took out the sewer. Waikato Regional Council's science manager Mike Scarsbrook told Morning Report producer Siobhan Wilson on Wednesday night the spill was first thought to be about 190 cubic metres, but it's now estimated 800 cubic metres found its way into the lake.
Now, 800 cubic metres is about a third the size of an Olympic swimming pool, so it's quite a significant amount of effluent to come out of the pipe and go into the lake. But it's in comparison to the volume of the lake and also to the flow of the Waikato River nearby, it's quite a small amount of water overall.
So we're talking about 800 cubic metres being dispersed throughout the entirety of Lake Taupo and the Waikato River. Is that a problem?
Well, it is, because it's a significant input of wastewater into what is a very high quality lake and into the upper Waikato River, which is a high quality water body as well. But what it does mean is that the effects of the lake and the river act to dilute the effects of that effluent. Now, we haven't yet got the results of the monitoring, so we don't know exactly what the levels of fecal indicator bacteria are in the river downstream. We have done some initial modelling work, which indicates that there would have been a reasonable size plume in the lake down towards the bottom end of Taupo and out into the Waikato River, and also potentially seeing a plume down the Waikato River, possibly as far as Aotearoa. But what we're actually looking at doing tomorrow is another series of sampling, which supports the sampling that Taupo District Council has already done, just to follow up on that modelling work, just to see if that modelling is actually accurate.
What is the downstream risk for the water supply?
Those water supplies immediately downstream are well aware of the risk and have stopped taking water. If we're talking about major water supplies or water takes further down the river, and particularly down as far as, say, Cambridge or Hamilton, the risk would be very minor.
How long does the water take to get from Taupo to, say, Cambridge or Hamilton, as you just mentioned?
It takes several days to move through that series of hydro lakes along the river.
And there's also, as I understand it, a forecast for rain. Is that going to help with dilution, or is that going to sort of speed up the flow of the river?
I guess that will increase the flow in the river. The flow in the river at Taupo is about 200 cubic metres per second. So putting it in the terms of a Olympic swimming pool, that means the Waikato River would fill a swimming pool in about 10 to 12 seconds. So that's at the flow it is currently. With heavy rain, obviously, a lot more water will be coming into the river and will dilute things further.
What is the advice to the public around swimming, fishing and drinking the water?
So essentially, at this stage, we're still treating this conservatively and identifying that there is likely to be a risk. And so the advice of the District Health Board should be followed in terms of accessing that water. We will get results of our sampling and Taupo District Council sampling over the next day or so, and we'll be able to likely be able to downscale those risks.
Will dispersal and dilution take care of things, or should we be worried?
I guess until we've got the samples, it's very difficult to be definitive about that. I was down there today. There was very little visible sign of any sort of fecal material, or there certainly was no sign of any gross pollution. I think the plume has moved down through the system. We did see some sediment near the shore on the lake, and so we will be looking at that further tomorrow to see just how extensive that is.
In terms of the sort of nasty stuff that ends up in rivers, how bad is urban effluent?
So what we tend to be concerned about are the pathogens that are contained in human waste, and obviously, human waste has the greatest level of infection risk generally, compared with things like cattle or birds. So human waste getting into waterways is a significant event and something obviously that we work hard to stop happening.
That's Mike Scarsbrook, the science manager of Waikato Regional Council, speaking on Thursday's Morning Report. Amazon needed reassurance after the Christchurch terrorist attacks that New Zealand was still a safe place to film before it agreed to make the world's most expensive television series here. Industry sources have confirmed to RNZ that New Zealand has been confirmed as the primary location for the $1.5 billion production of the Lord of the Rings series, in what an industry insider says will be a defining deal for the country. Our reporter Matthew Tunison filed this.
New Zealand nearly lost out on the astronomically lucrative deal to Scotland, which is now expected to play a smaller part in the TV series, according to a high-level film industry insider whose comments have been voiced to protect his identity. The New Zealand government provided reassurance to the huge multinational after March the 15th, while the tumultuous Brexit situation hindered Scotland's pitch.
When commissioning international television productions, they all have security reports and look at the risks and threats to international crews coming in. When New Zealand's status changed, there were very high-level talks between the New Zealand government and Amazon to assure them that it was a one-off event, that New Zealand remains a very safe place for international workers and film crews to work. It was pretty quickly laid to rest, and Amazon agreed and decided to move the production south.
The Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had a half-hour phone call with Amazon boss Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, on May the 2nd, but her office says their discussion was entirely about the Christchurch call. The Economic Development Minister David Parker also had a meeting with Amazon Studios, New Line Cinemas and the New Zealand Film Commission late last year. The insider says pre-production work is already underway at the Auckland Film Studios and the Kumu Film Studios to the northwest of the city. He's certain that Queenstown will also play a large part in the production.
Queenstown is going to play a huge part in the series, so there's a strong likelihood that the case for a studio being built there will be put forward. Most people in the industry believe there will be multiple developers looking at building studios in Queenstown. There are at least two developers working frantically at the moment to pitch their land as the venue for the Lord of the Rings studio.
As if there was any doubt as it stands, he says the series will forever associate New Zealand with the Lord of the Rings.
This, being the largest television production in the world, is an incredible opportunity for New Zealand to basically become Middle Earth forever. I mean, this is it. This is the defining moment. New Zealand, love it or not, is going to be Middle Earth. Amazon has a huge subscriber base globally, so you couldn't calculate the amount of exposure it'll get and what it will do to our tourism industry. Whether or not we need those tourists is another question, but it'll absolutely cement New Zealand as a tourist destination.
Lord of the Rings mega fan Kathy Udoch, who runs the One Ring website out of California, says the signs are pointing to the series being set a couple of thousand years before The Lord of the Rings. She says there are plenty of interesting storylines from this time in the unfinished J.R.R. Tolkien works, as well as in The Lord of the Rings appendices.
The fine line that the writers have always had to deal with is how to tell a story that appears in bits and pieces in different books. And not all of those books have licenses. How do you piece together what you can use without infringing on what you can't use and yet still not piss off all the fans who actually know what exists out there?
Ms. Udoch is cautiously optimistic about the series, especially seeing Jeff Bezos is reportedly a huge Lord of the Rings fan.
So what's nice about television versus film is you have the time to tell the story. Because one of the things that some of the fans of the books didn't like about the movies wasn't so much that they got things wrong, it's that they had to cut so much of it because the written work is so dense.
Filming of the Lord of the Rings series is expected to span 5 years.
Matthew Tunison with that report from Tuesday's Morning Report. Oranga Tamariki has revealed more details about the harm and abuse being done to children in its care and who is doing it. In March, the Ministry for Children published its first two Safety of Children in Care reports covering the 6 months to December 2018. In that period, there were more than 300 instances of neglect or emotional, sexual or physical abuse, and those responsible for it included caregivers, parents, other children, adult family members and Oranga Tamariki staff members. The Ministry has now given RNZ News more detailed figures about who has caused the harm Our social issues reporter Sarah Robson joined Susie Ferguson on Friday's Morning Report.
What do they tell us? These figures have been released to RNZ under the Official Information Act. Now, they show that there were 8 instances in the 6 months to December 2018 where Oranga Tamariki staff have caused harm against children in care. Now, there have been 6 instances of physical harm, 1 instance of emotional harm, and 1 instance of sexual harm. Now, it is worth noting that these numbers are small in the context of the 300 findings of harm over that 6 month period. And in fact, most of the harm being done to children in care was caused by caregivers. Now, caregivers can include whānau caregivers, non-whānau caregivers, and parent caregivers. So if we take a quick look at the 3 months between July and September, there were 120 physical harm findings, and whānau caregivers were found to be the abuser in 52 cases. Non-whānau caregivers were the abuser in 23, and 12 involved parents as caregivers. And when it comes to neglect, caregivers again are responsible for most of that harm, as they were for emotional harm. So in the context, the numbers are small when it comes to Oranga Tamariki staff members, but Oranga Tamariki itself has said that it is concerning that small number have been causing harm to children in its care.
So how do these figures differ to the information that was provided in March?
Yes, so Oranga Tamariki is going to be releasing these safety of children and care reports every quarter because it wants to be open and transparent about the harm that is being done to children in care, and it says it wants to learn from it. However, when these first 2 reports were released in March, the ministry didn't provide a detailed breakdown of the figures about alleged abusers or whether the harm occurred in a placement or outside of it. Instead, the different categories were represented on coloured bar graphs, and specific figures were only provided in some instances. When interviewed about the reports and their findings back in March, the Ministry's Chief Executive, Gráinne Moss, couldn't provide more detailed numbers about the exact figures of Oranga Tamariki staff involved, other than to say the numbers were low, and RNZ was asked to request those numbers under the Official Information Act.
What does Oranga Tamariki have to say about all this?
So in a statement, Oranga Tamariki's Deputy Chief Executive, Hawani Lambert, says they take this incredibly seriously, and it's completely unacceptable that anyone is discovered to have harmed a child, particularly a child in care. Now, Mr. Lambert says that Oranga Tamariki staff represent a small number of those found to have harmed a child. Regardless, even this number is intolerable, and in each instance they've taken immediate disciplinary action with those individuals to ensure they're dealt with appropriately. Now, in the original Official Information Act request, RNZ asked for details about what further action had been taken against Oranga Tamariki staff members, and the Ministry actually refused to provide those details under the Official Information Act. But the Ministry has now said that decisive action has been taken against those staff members, including working with the police on prosecution.
That's our social issues reporter, Sarah Robson, on Morning Report. And a Far North Māori Social Services Agency says it's been able to stop children being taken into state care by getting whānau to take responsibility instead. Oranga Tamariki has been under intense scrutiny over the number of Māori children being removed from their families. Katie Murray from Waitomo Papakāinga in Kaitaia says the ministry deserves thanks for making children's lives safe. She told our reporter Mariana Johnson that since October, they've stopped 47 children ending up in state care by making the most of whānau resources.
This is a choice that should be made prior to the state stepping in. This is how our tupuna used to do it, eh? In fact, they didn't even used to have whānau. Sometimes our grandparents used to just walk in and say, okay, we're having the mokopuna for 3 weeks and you fellas get your stuff together. So we like to think that it's not an ultimatum, but it's the choice that should be given to our whānau before the state has the last choice. So our choice is, put your children into whānau care with your whānau, and we'll have a look to make sure that it's the correct whānau, that it's safe for your children, and we will monitor that while you get the support that you need to get through your issues.
Aye. And is that a message that the whānau that you work with come around to? Or have there been any instances where the whānau said, nah, you know, oranga tamariki, if they have an issue, they can step in?
No, we've never had that. Never. You know, if you think that we've been doing this for more than 20 years and just less than 30, a lot of the families, whānau around this area, know about Waitomo. So they know that when we say something, we have tika, we have our kōrero is honest kōrero. I have been known to be straight up about a lot of things.
In what way?
Well, because our people need to know that they can't treat their children like that. They can't keep our children at mokopuna, tamariki mokopuna, in unsafe places with unsafe practices.
How do you manage to turn around those whānau?
Within my organisation, and we're only a small Māori organisation, but within it I have qualified social workers, I have counsellors, I have budgeters, I have all sorts of Māori whanaunga who have got the different skills and pohu. So when we work with a whānau, we do an assessment of their needs. We do the emergency housing here, so if we think that we need to, we'll put them into one of our emergency house placements and we'll monitor them. We'll set them up for all of their appointments, organise all their benefits, all their entitlements. We'll make the... So we also, you see, have really great relationships with all the other government agencies, so we can make appointments with the WINS, with corrections. We are in the courts. We know all the lawyers, all the judges, all the court staff. It's all really about relationships. So for Waitomo, our biggest plus, I suppose, is the recognition that we must build the relationships. And we've been here for 30-odd years, so we've built the relationships with a lot of government agencies and the other Māori organisations. So 12 years ago, I called a hui with all the Māori organisations up here, and I said, boy, we had better get it together. So out of that hui 12 years ago, we formed Te Kahu Oranga Whānau, which is a collaboration of four Māori NGOs up here, Māori iwi, and we've been working together collaboratively for the last 12 years, which helps us.
What we're hearing from some of the whānau is that despite their best efforts to do when they're working with oranga tamariki, they can't get their tamariki back. Through having these wraparound services and the relationships that your organisation has developed over the decades, are you seeing tamariki be reintegrated?
Oh, yeah. You see, and that's why we developed the whole thing about us going in, having whānau hui and us Waitomo placing children into their extended whānau before the state involvement. They're sitting right there on the edge and we're saying, well, actually, you know, we don't really need you, but ka pai to you. You know what, can I just say ka pai to them oranga tamariki? How many children must they have saved for us? And I have to say, come on, Māori whānau, stand up and be counted and take those children into your whānau.
Katie Murray, the head of Waitomo Papakāinga, speaking to our reporter Mariana Johnson, as heard on Wednesday's Morning Report. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, fighting the war on plastic rubbish just got easier for recycling businesses, and a boom in the number of wild geese stalking the grounds of Auckland's Western Springs has ruffled feathers at the local council, with the cull of the birds now on the cards.
They tend to congregate around the track, which is not good for our tram running to a timetable. Very, very difficult.
Still to come in The Week in Review. The Justice Minister, Andrew Little, says he's considering his options after Google said it saw no reason to change the way it operates after it named the man charged with murdering British tourist Grace Mullane. The accused man's name remains suppressed in New Zealand, but after his court appearance last December, his name appeared in a Google email sent to anyone who'd signed up to its What's Trending in New Zealand service. Mr. Little released an email from Google which said, "We have looked at our systems and it appears that last year's situation was relatively unique as it was a high-profile case involving a person from overseas which was extensively reported by overseas media. Google respects New Zealand law and we are engaging with local stakeholders." Andrew Little joined Corin Dan in our Morning Report Wellington studio.
Let's just run us through this. You met with Google in December or end of last year to reiterate concerns around this case.
I met with Google in December last year because by that time they had effectively breached the suppression order. The Prime Minister met with Google officials when she was in Davos in January last year. I got Ministry of Justice officials to follow up with Google in March this year because they had undertaken to get back to me about what they would do about it. They still said they were looking at it, and then I got them to follow up again recently, and they got back to us this week.
To say they do nothing?
To say they do nothing.
And what is your reaction to that?
Well, incredibly disappointed, actually. It was very clear to me in the conversation I had with them at the end of last year that they seemed to understand that breaching these suppression orders could compromise the fair trial rights of the guy accused of in this particular serious case. But they needed to make sure that their systems weren't compromised.
So you gave them
suppression
time,
orders generally.
You gave them some time to have a look. They've come back and said they can't do anything. What can you do about it now?
So that's I'm now asking justice officials about what options I might have. I know that last year Australia passed a whole heap of laws relating to social media platforms and what they do and the content they put up to exert some sort of control over that. We've got one thing I have to stand for as Justice Minister is the integrity of our justice system. There's a reason why we have suppression orders in the lead up to a trial. It is to preserve fair trial rights. It's the best chance that a victim has of seeing the person accused of harming them get a trial.
Can you give us an example of what you might be able to do? I mean, get some sort of gesture?
Well, I don't know. I just don't know. We can look at the Australian model, see whether the laws we can pass. I've got meetings with counterparts coming up in the next couple of months. I need to consider whether I need to raise it with them, a bit like the Christchurch Court, actually.
Would you go through the courts or would you take some sort of...
Could
it be court action against them, or what would you do?
Well, the Attorney General has the right to consider whether a contempt of court action is appropriate. I think there is a more systemic problem here. Google kind of considers their hands off because it's all just their software that gathers up news and harvests it again without any care about where that's being published into. They have to care about it. They have to care about whether or not they are breaching suppression orders. They are a publisher and they've got to be held to account.
Did you warn Google? Did you say to them, look, if you're going to ignore this, we will have to do something? Did you tell them?
Yes, I said that it is not acceptable that this should happen. They seemed to understand that. They seemed to accept it, said they would go away and have a look at their systems and make sure that they could operate them in a way that it didn't happen again. Now they're telling us they're not going to do anything. They described the situation last year as relatively unique. Well, it's not. They are capable of breaching suppression orders once. They're capable of breaching them again. So need to know that there has to be something more robust than just that protects fair trial rights
sure.
in New Zealand.
But do you want to be the minister in New Zealand, the country that takes on the might of Google, which is probably worth more than New Zealand's GDP in total?
Well, I've got to stand up for what's right for New Zealand in our system, in our system of justice. So big or small, like international corporations think they can operate in certain ways regardless of the country they're in. Actually, you do have to stand up to it. And we might be one voice now. I can talk to counterparts in other countries in the weeks that follow, and we can form a community of interest that says, actually, you guys, you sort this stuff out, or we'll work across borders ourselves as governments to protect the rights of our citizens going through our justice system.
I mean, is there a danger that we're not exactly we're not likely to be a big revenue earner for Google? I'm sure they make plenty of money out of New Zealand, but globally, that they'll just like, well, it's too difficult in New Zealand. They'll lose interest. They may lack and they may choose to not put investment in New Zealand if they're getting, hassled by the government.
Yeah, they know. Look, all of these big international corporations operate with a high degree of social license. They need the approval of the people who subscribe to them, who use them, and they are acutely aware of that. So, look, that was why the conversation I had with them in December last year seemed at least somewhat constructive. They were alert to the issues. They seemed to be keen to do something about it. So I'm disappointed to get the response that we have this week.
So the upshot is stake in the ground now. You've put a stake in the ground. You're going to do something. So we can watch the space. A few months' time, end of the year or something, we can expect you to make some announcement about action you're taking against Google.
Yeah, I've said to justice officials, right, give me advice on what options there are, because I've got to protect the integrity of our justice system here in New Zealand.
The Justice Minister Andrew Little on Wednesday's Morning Report. Fighting the war on plastic rubbish just got easier for recycling businesses. The Provincial Growth Fund is stumping up $40 million for companies investing in converting waste to usable products to try and slow down the amount of low-quality plastic being dumped in landfills. China and other countries refusing to take New Zealand's waste has been a much-needed wake-up call, according to the Associate Environment Minister Eugenie Sage. Monday's announcement came on the first day of Plastic-Free July, the official start of a ban on single-use plastic bags. Is our political reporter Joe Moyer from Monday's Checkpoint program.
The volume of waste going to landfills has increased by 20% since 2008, but Flight Plastics, a recycling company in Lower Hutt near Wellington, is changing the way plastic is recycled and reused. The third-generation family-owned operation received a grant from the government's Waste Minimisation Fund, which helped install the country's first PET wash plant in 2017. PET is low-grade plastic, used for things like soft drink bottles and takeaway food containers, which is the most difficult to recycle and most commonly ends up in landfills. Keith Smith is the chief executive of Flight Plastics and says consumers are already on board with recycling, but the funding from the PGF will help other businesses get set up and hopefully lead to more retailers paying to buy New Zealand recycled products.
Every PET container recycled at Flight gets a new life, and they come around and get a new life over and over again, each time saving the import of new material and saving waste going to landfill.
Eugenie Sage says the current Waste Minimisation Fund is up to $14 million a year, but it's always oversubscribed.
So that's why it is great news that the Provincial Growth Fund is providing a funding commitment to help establish more operations like this so that we recover more materials rather than sending our waste offshore. For too long, we've thought that waste can be sent away. China's National Sword Initiative, its ban on the import of waste products from other countries, has been a wake-up call.
The government says officials will seek out investment-ready proposals of significant scale in regional locations, close to main urban centres where much of the waste is made. Currently about 16,000 tonnes of new PET is imported, but only about 8,000 tonnes is recycled. Mr Smith says since the wash plant was established, there's been a 2,000 tonne decline in PET.
I think what everyone has to understand is it does cost a little bit of money to take care of the environment,
and,
so sometimes you've got to be prepared to pay an extra 2 cents for your tray of meat. But what you're doing is cleaning up the waste problem. So there is a cost to recycling in country.
It's not only plastics that the minister in charge of the PGF, Shane Jones, has in mind for the money. He says investing in ways to recycle tyres and lithium batteries will also be considered. The self-professed champion of the regions had his own metaphor in mind when explaining the tough nature of the plastic being recycled at the Lower Hutt factory.
If you're made of robust stuff, it just recycles endlessly. There's a political analogy there.
Mr Jones wants to see the fund used for commercial partnerships with Māori as well.
The people who often complain that we've been sluggish putting our money on the line are often local Māori hapū, who are sick and tired of seeing the negative downstream impact of landfills.
The announcement coincides with the start of the plastic bag ban, and the government is promising more policy to come on regulating the waste sector. While many shoppers in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch approached by RNZ this morning were on board with the single-use plastic bag ban, others thought it was a good start, but hoped stricter changes were to come.
I think it needs to be more with things like plastic bags with vegetables and fruit and that kind of thing. Cardboard boxes, that kind of thing, could be supplied easily.
I see people's bins and they are full of lots of plastic. Yeah. So I definitely think we one step in the right direction, but there's more to that needs to happen.
Retailers face a fine of $100,000 if they are caught handing out a single-use plastic bag.
Joe Moyer with that report from Checkpoint. The ANZ has told the Reserve Bank its proposal to make banks hold more capital will discourage productive investment and hurt economic growth. And all four of the big banks say it would lead to higher interest rates for borrowers. But members of the public have advised the Reserve Bank not to be fooled by what big Australian-owned banks tell it. On Monday, the Reserve Bank published the submissions it's received on its proposal. Two-thirds came from members of the public. Dr. Claire Matthews is from Massey University's Business School. She joined Corin Dan on Tuesday's morning report.
Is this scaremongering from our largest bank?
Oh, I don't think it's scaremongering. I think it's simply pointing out to the Reserve Bank and the public exactly what the risks are associated with, or the potential outcomes are associated with what the Reserve Bank is talking about doing.
Yeah, but credit rating agency S&P, I see last week, didn't seem to have much concern that the four major Australian banks would be affected.
Well, I guess that their concern is about the risks, and I guess if they're being asked to hold more capital, that's not likely to increase the risks.
Doesn't it follow, though, that if the banks are holding more capital, if they are safer, then presumably that might benefit the New Zealand economy, because that sort of interest rate premium which New Zealand can attract would be lower, wouldn't it?
Yes, but the reality is that if the banks are holding more capital, they're going to charge higher interest rates to borrowers, which is going to make lending more expensive, and also going to make it harder to get loans, because the banks won't have the same ability to make loans. So that's likely to have a disadvantage for the economy.
So they're just pointing out the way they see it, but is it just a reality that New Zealand needs to accept that we live, there's the threat of another GFC is always sort of there, if a low probability, and we must be ready for it?
Well, that's true to an extent, but it's a matter of how far you go. And I don't think anyone is really arguing about the fact that the bank should hold more capital. It's about the extent of the additional capital that is required. So even the big banks, I think, are not averse to holding more capital, but being asked to double the amount of capital that they're asked to hold, that's just going further than they think is necessary. And I note that the Reserve Bank talks about trying to reduce risk to a 1 in 200 year event. And my concern is that that's actually creating a false sense of security. If you think about floods, how many 1 in 200 or 1 in 500 year floods have we had in the last 10 years? So trying to protect against something that happens every 200 years is, in my view, simply not a realistic way to go.
I know that a lot of people are criticising the Reserve Bank and questioning the lack of cost-benefit analysis and these sorts of things, although I see they're saying they will release one at the end of the process. But isn't it fair to say they are the independent voice here? There's nothing in it for them. They don't have any, I guess, skin in the game of the banking industry. They're not trying to make money. They just want to deal with the long-term issues for New Zealand. Shouldn't we be trusting them?
We can trust them, but to say they've got no skin in the game isn't quite true, because the reality is if banks fail, then people are going to look at the Reserve Bank and say, what could you have done? You know, why didn't you prevent this? So the reality is that they do have an element of self-preservation associated with what they're doing.
Well, they're trying to preserve New Zealand's economy, aren't they? That's their preservation.
Certainly, but they're also there is a self-preservation for themselves as well, because as I say, if a bank fails, questions will be asked about what the Reserve Bank did. But certainly, a lot of what they're focusing in is on the wider economy and what's good for the country, no question of that. It's just a question of how far do you need to go to protect the country and the economy.
So just finally, you're worried that perhaps they are being a little bit too cautious?
That's my view, and I've said that from the start, that I agree, yes, the bank should hold more capital. I just think the Reserve Bank is going a little far in the extent of the requests that they're making, and there are concerns about what the impact will be on the smaller banks in particular, because they don't have the same access to capital, and it will be more challenging for them.
It's Dr. Claire Matthews from Massey University's Business School on Morning Report. A battle over how much Aucklanders should pay for their water is looming as a central issue in the city's mayoralty race. Candidate John Tamahere says if he wins, he will sell a 49% stake in Auckland's water provider, Watercare, and use the $4 billion he expects to raise on overhauling infrastructure. He says that will make Auckland's beaches safe for swimming. Auckland's mayor is Phil Goff. He joined Susie Ferguson on Morning Report.
This is a good idea, isn't it?
It's a dumb idea. It's a dumb idea for a variety of reasons, the most important of which is what this will effectively do is push up every Aucklander's water rates by $200 to $300 a year.
How?
And because you know, if you sell off the asset to an investor, or half of the asset, that's probably worth, the asset's worth about $10 billion. They want to get a return on $5 billion, and typically they'd get a return of 7 to 10%. Then they are going to add that to the prices of Aucklanders, and for the average family, that will knock up the price between $200 and $300 a year. But for a family with kids, of course, it's going to be a whole lot more. So the family that's struggling to pay their mortgage, raise their kids, they're going to be hit hard. And of course, low income people, this is like a flat tax. They will be paying a disproportionately high amount because it will be a higher proportion of their income. So it's going to hurt the low income, it's going to hurt families.
But the most important thing apart from that is that it takes an essential service, water, which is a monopoly, out of public control and accountability, and you pass control to the private sector, which is focused on the return that they make on that investment. That's why it's been rejected in the past, and it will continue to be rejected by Aucklanders. It's a dumb idea, it makes no sense, and it totally contradicts Mr. Tamahere's claim that he wants to bring these council-controlled organisations under greater public scrutiny. It'll actually lessen the control over that organisation, and significantly.
So you say he's flip-flopping over this, but don't people want greater infrastructure investment? Don't people want to be able to swim safely at Auckland's beaches? That wasn't the case last summer.
No, but he's used exactly the wrong example, because everybody in Auckland knows that what we have done in this council is bring forward plans to clean up our beaches and stop wastewater overflows from 30 years down to actually doing it within the next 9 years. We have voted the money for it. We have raised the money for it from a targeted rate on water and our other provisions for capital raising. And the only thing that is slowing us at the moment is getting the infrastructure built to achieve that. We start this year on the Central Interceptor project, which will reduce by about 90% the wastewater overflows right across the Western Isthmus. Mm. So, you know, we've also introduced a system called Safe Swim, which tells us exactly what the quality of water is in real time. It's not only New Zealand leading, it's world leading. And we've now sold that, the intellectual property rights, to use that to other cities, and that's producing a good return for Auckland. So we're onto that problem, we're resolving it, we've done it decisively.
Auckland's Mayor Phil Goff on Wednesday's Morning Report. Business confidence has fallen to its lowest level in a decade amid softer demand at home and a gloomier international outlook. The quarterly survey by the Institute for Economic Research found businesses are the least confident about their own outlook since 2009, with manufacturers the most downbeat. Paul Goldsmith is the National Party's finance spokesperson. He joined Corinne Dann on Morning Report.
I actually wonder if I could start first with a comment on what that we just heard in that interview there with Phil Goff. Would National support a partial privatisation of Auckland's water care?
Look, I think we're certainly open to finding new ways to come up with the money for infrastructure investment. And whether that's through equity or whether it's through different funding mechanisms, I think we should be open to that question. I wouldn't commit right here, right now, having just heard that, to precisely what Mr. Tamahere is talking about. But the broader question of attracting more private sector capital into infrastructure investment in New Zealand is the right question to be asking.
Even if it is a fundamental issue like water that is currently, you know, it's a monopoly basically at the moment, isn't it? You'd be open to that being then exposed to the private sector.
No, well, see, that's the point. I think we need to have a discussion about what's the best way to bring new capital into infrastructure investment. And it's not just water. I mean, of course, it's roads. It's the ports. The ports, for example, we have a mix of private ownership and not. And so I do think we need to have that discussion, because there's so much work that needs to be done in New Zealand across infrastructure that we need to be asking that question and open to different ways of doing things, while always at the same time making sure that we deliver basic public services at a reasonable price to New Zealanders.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because we do have a lot of infrastructure problems looming. So are you signalling that perhaps as National's finance spokesperson, that is an area you want to explore, and that a future National government might return to partial privatisations if it could be demonstrated that they do provide better services than that funding that's needed?
Well, I think the mixed ownership model worked very well in terms of the power companies, and it's been very, you know, very positive for the country. So, yes, we should have these discussions and be open to, like I say, bringing in private sector capital in order to build the infrastructure that we need for a growing and expanding economy. The sad point at the moment, of course, is that there's a big question about how quickly we're going to be growing in the next little while because of the falling levels of business confidence.
Yeah, let's talk about that. How much of that is being driven really by this sort of ongoing uncertainty globally? We're seeing Australia's economic performance deteriorate. They're growing slower than New Zealand. We're being dragged down, aren't we?
Look, there's a bit of both. Look, the Prime Minister and Grant Robertson will duck and dive and blame, you know, Donald Trump and the Iranians and everybody else. And there is an element of international activity, but there's also a very substantial element, which is the domestic situation in New Zealand. And that's what the government has to take responsibility for. I mean, we should be booming as a country, bearing in mind that our export prices, our terms of trade, are at historically high levels. We've got an economy where the books are in good shape. We've had big surpluses. There's plenty of money to invest, and the prices are high, and yet we've had a sharp decline in the economy since this government took over.
It's no coincidence, is it, though, really, that we were just talking about house prices in Auckland, house prices down. Confidence is taking a battering in part because of house prices. I mean, was it really a good thing that, yes, we were booming at 4% 2 or 3 years ago, but house prices were going off the charts in Auckland, and that was causing all sorts of damage, including a housing crisis?
Yeah. The housing prices were a very important issue to be focused on. But what's contributing to the low levels of business confidence definitely is all the uncertainty that this government has created right across the economic settings. The most dramatic example was 18 months of uncertainty around whether there was going to be a capital gains tax or not. That's been resolved, but the government's still on the hook for the damage that did to the economy over that period.
But so why is business still grumpy? If that's, well, because that's been scrapped, and so this survey would have picked that up, right?
Yeah, but
it would have picked that up.
Yeah, but there's lots of proposals still out there. There's all sorts of industrial relations talk, the fair pay agreements. There's the way that they've gone about their decision making. I mean, that oil and gas decision still rankles.
Is that just political politics, and that the business community is in general probably going to largely support National? This is a sentiment driven thing around they don't like the Labor government. But really, what's changed in terms of a business wanting to sell its goods or services globally?
What's changed is that you've got a bog-standard left-wing government in place here, which has got two basic responses. One is massively increased spending. Some of it is justified, some of it is wasted.
Hang on. What are they spending as a percentage of the economy?
Oh, well, it's just under 30%.
Yes, and what did the last National government spend as a percentage of the economy?
Well, it was a little bit lower in the mid-20s. Yeah, well, the point was, though, that we had come from
you just made the claim that this government's ratcheting up all sorts of spending.
Well, it has, because in this budget, which was just passed a month ago, the new spending allowance was just under $4 billion for the year. So new spending of $4 billion. Previous government, it was about $1 billion a year. So
yes, but the economy's grown. Isn't that justified? You're paying for population increases, paying for infrastructure, you're paying for things that arguably your government was criticised for not paying for.
Sure, the point is that some of that spending is useful. And if you look at the mental health in the budget, most people agree. But a lot of it is very poorly targeted, such as the free freeze leading to no new students, the provincial growth fund stuff, which is one part economic development, nine parts slush fund, and many other areas. So that's one thing. But at the same time, they don't have any focus or appreciation that particularly businesses which are internationally competitive do struggle to cope with added costs. And so this government at every turn just adds costs, whether it's through the industrial relations front or new regulations or just deciding that this industry, for whatever reason, no longer fits with our agenda, such as oil and gas.
Just before we go, give me one regulation that affects an export business in this country that's somehow making it more costly.
Well, the massive tightening of the overseas investment rules. So you've got the Minister Sage just saying that we're so rich now that we don't need to look for gold, and I'm not going to do it.
How does that affect a New Zealand exporter trying to sell its wares overseas?
Well, the effect is that you're dealing with a government that's very hard to predict in any way, shape or form. And so the obvious reaction for any business person who's thinking about making an investment is to keep their hands in their pocket to wait and see what this government will do next. And that's what's slowing down the economy, is this 600,000 businesses out there saying, heck, I don't know what this government's going to come up with next. It's a dangerous time. You look around the world, it's also dangerous. And you say, well, I'll just keep my hands in my pockets and wait. And that is what's leading to the slowdown that we're seeing.
That's the National Party's finance spokesperson, Paul Goldsmith, on Wednesday's Morning Report. Maritime New Zealand is investigating reports of an oil spill around Three Kings Islands, 55 kilometres northwest of Cape Reinga. A fishing vessel reported oil on fishing gear and on a small number of seabirds around the islands on Monday. Nigel Clifford is with Maritime New Zealand. He joined Susie Ferguson on Morning Report.
What have you discovered?
So, Susie, at the moment, the information's still fairly sketchy. We have the report from the fishing vessel,
But unfortunately, the weather's been very poor, so we've not been able to do any detailed overflights to get any more information.
So what have you been able to do?
So the fishing boat provided the report that the fishing gear was oiled with what looks like black oil, and that a small number of seabirds in the vicinity of the boat also appeared to have been affected by the oil. We take these things very seriously, so basically we're now going to do a thorough investigation as soon as the weather allows to check whether there are any further effects or further impacts.
When are you going to get a break in the weather?
The forecast is suggesting that not today, possibly tomorrow or at the start of the weekend.
Have you got any photographs at all, for example, of the oil spill, of the birds?
Not of the birds. The Defence Force support has been really good throughout, and we were able to get some high-resolution pictures from a C-130 Hercules that was in the area. Careful analysis of those suggests that there's no oil, but it's actually very difficult to see through that type of photograph. You know, it's much better to try to get on scene.
Okay, so are you're still talking about flyovers, but are you actually going to be able to get a boat out there to have a look?
The challenge with the weather for a boat is there's quite a lot of swell, there's a lot of wind, and obviously in a boat you're at very low level, you're right in and on the sea. So the best thing is a sort of focused helicopter trip where we can have a good look at the shoreline and a good look at the sea. So a boat is an option once the weather gets a little bit better, but it's not probably not going to be as effective.
Where could this oil have come from?
So that's simply unknown at the moment, though we are looking into information that we have on vessels that have been operating in the area, and we're going to follow that up as a separate investigation. So we don't know at the moment, but it is possible that vessels passing through the area could be the source.
You're talking about the swell making the conditions difficult. Will that also have broken up any oil that is in the area?
Yes, Susie, that's absolutely right. So the weather is both a help and a hindrance. It's a hindrance in terms of being able to do that detailed on-scene look, but it's actually very useful for beginning that natural process of breaking down the oil.
If oil is found, what preparations are underway or have been made for a clean-up operation?
So we've been looking at the options using all of the different tools and techniques that we have. So it's highly unlikely that you could do any collection on the ocean itself, given the sort of state of the ocean up there. But we're probably more interested in the wildlife and in the shoreline impact. It is possible to do shoreline cleanup. It very much depends on the balance between the interference by doing the cleanup versus the damage that might be done if you leave it. So it's a very fine call, which is why we need to work out exactly what has gone on. It may be best to do nothing at all. And the wildlife, again, that involves quite difficult issues around wildlife capture and treatment. So you need to be very careful about how you progress with all of this. Information is really key. So we have a range of options that we're ready to do if necessary.
That's Nigel Clifford from Maritime New Zealand on Thursday's Morning Report. A boom in the number of wild geese stalking the grounds of Auckland's Western Springs has ruffled feathers at the local council, with the cull of the birds now on the cards. Park users are crying foul over the birds' waste and aggressive behaviour and want them brought into line. But Aucklanders keen to save the birds from the chop have offered up new homes, with dozens of birds likely to be saved. Our reporter Nita Blake-Person went out on a wild goose chase to find out more and filed this for Wednesday's Checkpoint programme.
Gaggles of feral geese are the first thing you see or hear upon arrival at Western Springs. The birds have ruled the roost here for decades, but in the past 12 months or so, the numbers have really taken off, creating quite the flap.
Quite aggressive. It's just more that they're very hard to shoo off, unlike birds other places. So the kids don't know that they're aggressive, so often you get your hands bitten and things like that.
Well, there's definitely a poo problem. We, you know, we have to have a bit of a shower almost after we come here. That's how you got the boots.
Have you ever felt personally victimised by the geese here?
A long time ago, when I had children in a buggy or grandchildren or something, they did come up and try and, yes, attack.
Dennis drives the trams around the park and is sick of them swanning around the tracks.
Well, there's rather too many of them. And they tend to congregate around the track, which is not good for our tram running. And running to a timetable, very, very difficult.
What problems do they cause?
Well, we have to almost stop the tram so the geese find their own time to waddle out of the way.
Walking through the park, it's a constant battle to dodge the plethora of poo all over the place. The geese eat up to 3 kilograms of grass a day and excrete 1.3 kilograms of waste. That's degrading the park's waterways, and the council is now having to clean the crap off the footpaths daily. Waitamata local board member Rob Thomas says the council's contractor, which was supposed to be monitoring the birds, has dropped the ball. He says the shaking of eggs, or cuddling as it's known, has been overlooked.
The eggs have not been cuddled by the contractors, and what that does is it prevents the births of the geese, and so there's been a boom in the population.
But when Mr Thomas heard an Auckland council officer's plans to cull the geese in 2 weeks' time to a more manageable number, he hatched a plan.
Auckland, I need your help. I'm calling for anybody who would like to have geese on their properties.
He put a call out on social media, which has now been viewed more than 50,000 times, with offers from all over the country.
Last night I had a woman from Hokianga give me a call, wanting to house some geese, and I've also been contacted by West Coast to the South Island as well. We're not going to be able to save all of them, unfortunately, but we will be able to save many.
Mr Thomas says some birds aren't suitable for adoption as they're injured or sick, and while he suspects foul play may have motivated some of the offers, any new homes will be thoroughly vetted. Auckland Council will spend the next couple of weeks assessing which geese are suitable for rehoming and which ones need to be culled. It reckons of the 160 or so birds that are currently here, that number needs to get down to around 20 or 30. But because geese mate for life, they'll be assessing which pairs need to stay together as they move on. Rob Thomas says he's been overwhelmed by the positive response to the bird's plight, but says people can stop calling him now.
At the moment, I'm getting a message probably every 30 minutes from someone, so please stop. Stop messaging me. We're done. So we're not going to be able to save all of them, unfortunately, but we will be able to save many.
News that the bird numbers would soon be dropping was welcomed by these park users.
Would I take on a geese recently? No. But that's cool that they want to find new homes for them.
Cut back on the how many eggs are in the nest, I guess. That'll be a way to do it.
A cull before they were, before they've come overpopulated might be a good idea.
And Auckland Council says it will be working with its maintenance contractor to ensure the birds' numbers don't take flight again.
Nita Blake-Person with that report from Checkpoint. And finally, in the Week in Review, Forest and Bird are calling on the government and councils to increase their 1080 predator control, saying rats are running riot through the nation's forest and tussock land. The environmental group says a bumper crop of autumn seeds has fuelled a rat plague, but warns the worst is yet to come, with a plague of stoats predicted next. Pete Morton is the Conservation Department's Predator Control Program Coordinator. He joined Susie Ferguson on Tuesday's Morning Report.
This year, you're expecting, you've got a rat plague and you're expecting a stoat plague. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Stoats actually feed off rats. So with the exceptional numbers of rats that we've got in our forests this year, that will lead to high numbers of stoats as well later in the year around summer.
Did you say that stoats feed off rats?
Yeah. They eat our wildlife as well, but the main thing that they survive on and that drives their populations are actually rats.
Righto. So that's quite a plague then that is coming. Should you be dropping more 1080 than you are?
Well, we're running at our limits actually this year. We've built up our program to the biggest ever. We're aiming to treat over 1 million hectares this year, which is really at the limits of what our current predator control capacity can cope with.
So you're doing as much as you can, even though you're facing a plague?
Yes. We were really fortunate in that our scientists have learnt how to predict these mast events about a year ahead of them occurring. So we had a early warning, and we were able to respond to, you know, from that, and gear up to increase our program. We also got funding support from government to boost a normal level of work. So we've been able to set ourselves up to cover as much ground as is feasible and can be covered safely in the, you know, the time that we've got to work with.
But are you running predator control over only 12% of conservation land? Is that right?
Yeah, that's
And is
right.
that enough?
Well, it's what we can do. It's as much as can be covered safely at this point in time.
That's the Conservation Department's Predator Control Program Coordinator, Pete Morton, on Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki, have a great week.